segregated over the years. My guest, Josh Silver, has studied this extensively and has written a book called Ending Redlining Through a Community-Centered Reform of the Community Reinvestment Act. Monday's morning show begins just after 8.
Good morning. This is the BBC World Service with Millicent McIntyre. And now, news from the war front. Several major British naval convoys in the North Atlantic report a number of German U-boat wolf packs in close proximity to those convoys. No sinking or damage reports have been released by the British Naval Command at this time. We will continue to monitor these events and report them to you as warranted. In other news, Prime Minister Churchill has convened Parliament and will make an address later today.
Good morning and welcome to the WGTD Radio Theater in this, our 14th season. This is program number 114 since the inception of this 12-time award-winning radio theater series. Today, we transport you back to 1942, right in the heart of London, along with other locations that were vitally important points of geography during World War II. Our story today is the original docudrama, The Enigma Covenant. And our stars, as always, are from the 91.1 Players, directed by Vicky Dumay. Our radio playwrights are Stephen Brown and Michael Ulstrup, who also serve as co-executive producers. Support for the WGTD Radio Theater is provided by the Kenosha Law Firm of Aaliyah, Dumay, and McTernan, a full-service law firm with an emphasis on personal injury, civil litigation, and business law. Also by the Brown Ulstrup Performing Arts Foundation, located in the village of Salem Lakes, Wisconsin. And now, today's story. One that many of you probably have never heard before. Bletchley Park, located in a small Buckinghamshire town about 50 miles north of London. It was easily the most closely guarded and enduring secret of World War II. Thousands of books, articles, and one-on-one interviews by the generals, admirals, and civilian leadership masterminding the war were all silent on the subject. The usually loquacious Winston Churchill said nothing about it in his six-volume history of the Second World War. The 12,000 men and women who were there, sworn by an oath to king and country, neither spoke nor wrote anything for three decades after the war. They remained silent until the mid-1990s.
Ladies and gentlemen, here is Prime Minister Churchill as he addresses Parliament on the status of the war.
We must all be prepared to meet gas attacks, parachute attacks, and glider attacks with constancy, forethought, and practiced skill in order to win the war. Hitler must destroy Great Britain. With every month that passes, he is now holding down by brute force and vile intrigue, a learning to hate the Prussian yoke and the Nazi name as nothing has ever been hated so fiercely and so widely among men before. And all the time, masters of the sea and air, the British Empire, nay, in a certain sense, the whole English-speaking world will be on his track, bearing with them the swords of justice.
We now return you to our regular broadcast, but we shall interrupt our programming at any time to bring you important news events. For the BBC, I'm Millicent McIntyre.
Continuing our broadcast this morning, with all of that important information in mind, it's time to open another chapter in the Codebreakers of Bletchley Park. I think it would be best if we let Winifred Mary Scott continue our story, since she was in charge of just about everything that went on in Hut No. 8 at Bletchley.
Let me first explain to you in clear and precise words just how BP was created and laid out. And of course, when I say BP, I mean Bletchley Park. This sort of detail will give you the kind of overall arching perspective on just how important the British government, And more specifically, Sir Winston Churchill realized that we needed to be able to break the German code that was already proving to be deadly, especially out on the North Atlantic, as the Nazi U-boats were destroying British ships. Throughout the summer of 1939, as Europe prepared for war, Bletchley Park swarmed with workmen. The roads around the mansion itself, which was in the center of the grounds, were relaid with very thick concrete. A new water main was installed, as were big, heavy electrical cables, all buried deeply underground.
Excuse me, Miss Smith?
Yes, what is it, Margaret?
Well, two things. Number one, we just received this communique from the HMS Birmingham about a wolf pack of U-boats.
Oh, what are the coordinates?
I think I should tell you that in private, don't you, Miss Smith?
You're probably correct, Miss Bradshaw. Thank you. Please proceed with your processing and inform Mr. Babbage.
Yes, ma'am.
And the other item?
Oh, yes, sorry. Three women from the OSS are here for their top secret training.
I didn't know that the Office of Strategic Services started using women as spies.
Yes, ma'am, they have. Bill Donovan just initiated Project Petticoat.
Really?
That's right, Mrs. Smith. Wild Bill Donovan decided to use women as OSS spies as part of his new plan. Here's what he said.
We needed to make some inroads into the whole Nazi world of espionage, as well as getting agents into Japan. Women have a knack for getting their way. Or to be even more specific, it's easier for them to slip behind enemy lines. The Nazis didn't expect us to use women as spies. Isn't that right, Betty? Oh, well, excuse me. Let me introduce Elizabeth McIntosh. I call her Betty.
That's correct, General Donovan. The so-called Morale Operations Division of the OSS represented the war effort's propaganda arm. This is where we trained women writers, foreign speakers, educators, or those who simply had a flair for the dramatic. They were recruited to write or broadcast disinformation that was transmitted abroad. The idea was to cool the heels of enemy combatants by encouraging them to quit the battlefield. One such operation, Project Marigold, incorporated two radio stations, one in New York and another at 432 Post Street in San Francisco.
Betty, when I decided to train women as spies, you would not believe the number of senators who screamed at me. You would have thought I was taking away their youngest child. It was quite remarkable.
The calls from the senators or having women in the OSS?
Oh, both. Betty, did I hear you mention Virginia Hall earlier today?
No, sir, I didn't.
Virginia Hall, the limping lady. Now there was an agent.
She was one of the best, General. One of the best.
Virginia Hall, the limping lady, as she would come to be called, resided in Paris on the day the war broke out. She volunteered for the French ambulance service until Germany occupied France, then moved to London, where she worked for the U.S. Embassy in London as a code clerk. Because she was fluent in French and knew the terrain well, British Special Operations recruited her to return to France and work undercover. Out of an apartment in Lyon, Hall began planning train derailments and other sabotage missions in collaboration with the French underground. Her crews also smuggled downed American airmen and escaped POWs back to England. More on the limping lady, Virginia Hall, in a bit later. And now, let's get back to our story and rejoin Winifred Smith at Bletchley Park, as it appears that those three new OSS recruits, three women, are waiting in her office. Catherine McPherson, Agnes Gottschalk, and Millicent Kennedy, three women who will one day be known as our secret sisters.
So tell me, ladies, just what is your OSS assignment here at Bletchley? Which one of you is in charge?
In charge? If you have some smooth scotch whiskey in a glass, I'll be in charge.
Agnes, you know you aren't the head witch in charge here.
Yeah, I know. But with a few belts of whiskey, I could be just as good as Catherine.
Catherine McPherson?
Oh, she's the quiet one over there.
Miss McPherson?
Yes?
What is your responsibility with the OSS?
The OSS?
The Office of Strategic Services.
My training at Yale University was in cryptography.
Really? Yale University. Impressive.
Alan Turing at your Bletchley Park, along with codebreaker Leo Marx, are experts in the poem code method, which is a simple yet insecure cryptographic method.
I've heard about that.
Has Turing been using it here at Bletchley?
Agnes, why don't you answer that for Miss Smith?
Ah, the poem code method. This method works by the sender and receiver prearranging a poem to use. The sender chooses a set number of words at random from the poem and gives each letter in the chosen words a number. The numbers are then used as a key for some cipher to conceal the plain text of the message. The cipher used was often double transposition, to indicate to the receiver which words have been chosen. An indicator group is sometimes sent at the start of the message.
Agnes, is there anything else you'd like to share with Miss Smith?
Oh, just one last thing.
Let me guess. The poem method is insecure, for if one message is broken by any means, including threat, torture, or even cryptanalysis, future messages will be readable if the source poem has been identified. Since the poems used must be memorable, there is a temptation to use well-known poets, poems from well-known poets, like Keats, Poe, or Elizabeth Browning.
Miss Smith, I am impressed with your knowledge of such matters.
Millie, I had a wonderful cryptology professor at Oxford.
Oh, what was his name?
Professor Kenneth Wellingham. He was remarkable.
Well, what made him so special?
He would have been such a star here at Bletchley, but he died during a bombing in London in 1940. He could see things that no one else could see. Unfortunately, he didn't know ahead of time that the Nazis were going to bomb the office where he was working.
Oh, that's a shame. Let me ask you a question. Do you mean that Professor Wellingham could see into the future?
No, Agnes, but he could see that the root ciphers have many more keys than a rail fence. In fact, he knew even before Alan Turing that four messages of reasonable length, the number of possible keys, is potentially too great to be enumerated even by modern machinery.
He knew what was bad, didn't he?
Yes. He could tell if badly chosen routes would leave excessive chunks of plain text or text simply reversed. And this would then give cryptanalysis a clue as to the routes.
As you can see, Miss Smith, the three of us were sent here for a very special reason.
Catherine, I will have Margaret escort you to Hut 8 so you can begin your BP orientation.
Thank you, Miss Smith.
Ladies, please come with me. I will see you three secret sisters later in the day. Sorry for that interruption, but General Donovan wanted me to make sure that his three new recruits were properly welcomed. Where was I? Oh, yes. Here at Bletchley, there's always something going on, 24 hours a day. Before I take you into Hut 8, where the real work at BP takes place, I've asked Captain Horatio Faulkner, who's head of Joint Naval Operations, to talk to you ever so briefly about U-boats. Captain.
Thank you, Miss Smith. One of Hitler's best weapons to hinder successful Allied convoy trips was the U-boat, which in German is called Das Unterseeboot. These U-boats attacked almost at will British ships because the commanders knew, through the Enigma codes, the specific coordinates of Allied ships as they passed through convoy routes. Those Enigma machines were remarkable. They allowed the Germans to communicate back and forth, at least in the beginning, unfettered. In other words, they did whatever the blazes they wanted to. We were helpless. That is, until computer genius Alan Turing, with the help from the Polish underground and their remarkable work, stepped up to help us locate the proper cribs. And then we located the proper sharks.
Allow me, if you please, to interrupt Captain Faulkner for a moment. Before we take you below the surface of the cold North Atlantic, I've asked the well-known British mathematician, Dr. Alan Turing, who all but invented the computer, to describe to you, in a language you and I can understand, just how the Enigma machine, or should I say, the cipher machine, actually works. Dr. Turing.
Thank you. I am always in awe of everyone who works at Bletchley. Their efforts, their passion for what they do. I have been asked to talk about the Enigma machine, which I shall do. My own mathematical background comes from the work and efforts of A.S. Eddington, from J. von Neumann's account of the foundations of quantum mechanics, and then from Bertrand Russell's mathematical logic. And then it was from the lectures of the topologist Max Neumann that I learned of Gödel's 1931 proof of the formal incompleteness of logical systems rich enough to include arithmetic, and of the outstanding problem in the foundations of mathematics as posed by Hilbert, which was called the decision problem. I then asked the question, was there a method by which it could be decided for any given mathematical proposition whether or not it was provable? Yes, the Enigma machine and how it works. The Enigma machine is a simple cipher machine. It has several components, a plug board, a light board, a keyboard, a set of rotors, and a reflector, half rotor. The original machine looked a lot like a typewriter. The machine has several variable settings that affect the operation of the machine. The user must select three rotors from a set of rotors to be used in the machine. A rotor contains one-to-one mappings of all the letters. Some Enigma machines had more than three rotors, which just added to the number of possible encryption combinations.
Professor Turing, tell us more about these rotors, how they work, and anything else important about them.
Yes, of course. I am always asked, how many different combinations or permutations are there if three rotors are used? There are five rotors, of which three may be chosen and inserted into any position. This gives us five ways of choosing the first rotor, four ways of choosing the second, and three ways of choosing the third, i.e. 60 ways of choosing our rotors. Each rotor can have 26 starting positions, assuming a 26-letter alphabet. This gives an additional 263 or 17,576 ways of setting our chosen rotors. This gives us, so far, a total of 1,054,560 combinations. This is already a daunting number of keys to search through without benefit of computers, but we haven't stopped there. Let me tell you about the mechanics of actually using this typewriter-like Enigma machine. When a key is pressed, like this, an electrical current is sent through the machine. The current first passes through the plug board, then through the three rotors, through the reflector, which reverses the current, back through the three rotors, back through the plug board, and then the encrypted letter is lit on the display. After the display is lit up, the rotors rotate. The rotors rotate similar to an odometer, where the rightmost rotor must complete one revolution before the middle rotor rotated one position, and so on.
Let me ask you this, Professor. What kinds of assumptions are made when messages are sent using this Enigma machine?
There must be a sense of truly having what I like to call an Enigma covenant. That is, in all cipher systems, one assumes the message has been intercepted. The objective is then to make it impossible, or at any rate, very difficult and time-consuming, for the interceptor to decrypt the message. In any practical cipher system, it must also be assumed that the interceptor will at some point find out the general system that is being used.
And the security of it all?
The security of the message resides in preventing the interceptor from finding out the message key, the specific details of exactly how the system was configured for sending that particular message. It is vital that there is a secure way of communicating the message key to the intended recipient. Another necessity of a useful cipher system is that there should be a vast number of different possible message keys. For example, there would be different ways in which the system could have been configured when the message was enciphered. Otherwise, the interceptor can simply try them all out.
Dr. Turing, thank you for your analysis and your perspective on the Enigma. I hope that you'll join us a bit later in this broadcast.
I would be most pleased to do so. Thank you for inviting me. I will be back.
We are just receiving radio communications from one of those German U-boats, actually from U-110. The commander of U-110 is 28-year-old Fritz Julius Lemp. For purposes of this story, we will hear Lemp and his German crew speaking English.
Lieutenant, what is our current position?
Commander, we are currently located at 60 degrees, 28 minutes north, and 32 degrees, 40 minutes west. Our communication links to the other U-boats are 5x5.
Thank you, Lieutenant.
Commander, what is the makeup of the convoy we are following?
It's convoy OB-318. Let me tell you about the destroyers.
Now, why is that important?
Because of the assets. What their arsenal's capabilities are.
Yes, sir.
The seventh group consists of the destroyers Vescat, Newmarket, and Campbelltown. The corvettes Primrose, Marigold, Nasturtium, Dianthus, and Aurora. The sloop Rochester and the Trawler Angle.
Do you ever worry, Commander?
What do you mean?
Do you worry about the Enigma machine being captured?
We are trained by Admiral Donitz to make sure we take all precautions.
Commander, what makes Admiral Donitz so brilliant?
Here's what I think. And let me also say that I have only met the Admiral once, when he was appointed commander of the fleet during the early years of World War II. He turned the U-boats, just like this one, into a serious threat to Britain's survival. The first boat to make contact was designated as the Shadower, whose job was to maintain contact and to report the convoy's position back to the U-boat Wolfpack commander. The Shadower would then remain out of the visible range of the convoy, often submerging by day and traveling on the surface by night. When enough boats have converged with the convoy, the U-boat Wolfpack commander would then give the signal to attack, usually after dusk, where the U-boat's small silhouette made detection difficult. It was sheer genius.
Until we are sunk by those depth charges.
Mr. Ulrich, we have the Enigma machine on board this boat and have to protect it with all our might, power, and guidance from above.
Yes, sir. I agree.
Thank you, Lieutenant.
Before we proceed further with our story today, I've asked the Honorable James Franklin Devenham, who is mayor of Milton Keynes in County Buckinghamshire, to provide all of us some additional background about how Bletchley Park was created. This information will give you a real glimpse at how secretive and just how hush-hush everything was back in 1939. Mayor Devenham, let me turn the platform over to you.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate this opportunity to talk to you about Bletchley Park. In the spring of 1938, local builder Captain Hubert Faulkner, who owned this stately mansion here in Buckinghamshire, was approached by the British government on behalf of the Government Code and Cipher School, and the property was leased to it for a period of 3 months. At the end of 3 months, the property was purchased by the government. In fact, it was actually for use by the intelligence agency, MI6, and the Government Code and Cipher School. The government claimed it was to be used for training purposes by the Air Ministry. A story in the Bletchley District Gazette at the time said that the government claim had been refuted by its sources in Whitehall, and that whatever was going on at the park was obviously hush-hush. Hush-hush, yes. Everything was considered to be hush-hush. In the latter part of 1938, a radio listening station, one of a chain of similar stations spread throughout the country, was established in a small room under a turreted water tower situated in the mansion. It was called Station 10, and, being usually written with a Roman numeral, it was later known as Station X. Its extensive antennae ran first to a cedar tree some 30 meters from the mansion's front door, then to several elm trees, first beside the lake, and finally to another near the present tennis courts. A return wire to the mansion completed the antenna loop. The real purpose of the station was to maintain contact with the British embassies. As mayor of Buckinghamshire, I was right in the middle of this charade, as our town folks were all quite curious over what was going on. Local interest was aroused when, in late August of 1938, Captain Ridley's shooting party arrived. Throughout the month, the various groups composed of middle-aged men and a number of young women were accommodated in the local hotels. Each morning they went off to Bletchley Park and returned to their hotels that evening.
Did you tell them just how secretive all this was?
Oh yes, of course I did. The secret was held for all of that time. Not only by the original visitors who began working there in September, but by the thousands of people who would later join them over the next 6 years. Captain Ridley, leader of the so-called shooting party, was in fact a naval officer attached to MI6, who later organized a permanent move to Bletchley. I must depart now, as my wife has my lunch ready, and I don't wish to keep her and the children waiting. You know how that goes. Thank you for this opportunity to speak with you.
Well, thank you, Mayor. The Enigma Covenant is the name of our story today, and the person who will take us into the portholes of Hut Number 8 at Bletchley is Miss Phoebe Senyard. She worked for the Naval Section of MI6 and has just been assigned to Bletchley.
Henrietta, please take this cable over to Hut 8 for further deciphering. Thank you, sweetie. Well, here I was, just one day to prepare for my transfer to Bletchley. My assignment was to the German Navy's radio branch. Since I knew very little about German naval traffic in the North Atlantic, except for my knowledge about naval enigma, I must confess that it was with fear and a great deal of trembling, usually late at night, that I went to Bletchley. Indeed, I did try to protest, but I was told that it was only for a fortnight, so I gave in.
Miss Senyard, were you allowed to say anything to your family, your parents, about where you were working? I don't mean what you were doing, but even where?
Oh, there was nothing I could tell them at all, really. But there was this man in the Naval Section called A.J. Allen. He was a BBC commentator, and his real name was Leslie Lambert. I've also heard it said that Mr. Lambert invented the quintessential BBC accent. He also had a half-hour wireless program where he told funny stories, simple stories, just funny things about life in London. But there was nothing I was able to tell my mother. But I did say to her one time, "You'll never guess who I work with, A.J. Allen." She didn't believe me.
What else can you tell us about Bletchley?
Oh, the food.
The food? What about the food?
Well, Admiral Hugh Sinclair, the head of MI6, used some of his financial resources and brought in a top chef from London to look after the codebreakers. There were long tables with the finest gourmet food, with a full waitress staff, bowls of fruit, baked chicken, ham, beefsteak puddings. Oh, it was all quite remarkable. Now, let me take you into Hut 8 so you can see and hear for yourself what's going on. Professor Knox, what is the status of the Turing machine? Have you made any headway?
Let me be clear. The Germans are making a lot of major mistakes with their codes. It puzzles me greatly.
What do you mean?
I mean, if used properly, the Enigma was unbreakable. But the Germans made mistakes. They also made a great number of serious procedural errors. They forgot to change key settings. They sent the same message twice. They also used non-random message keys, like AAA or ASD. And on key sheets, they sometimes put the same rotor wheel in the same position 2 days running.
Like my colleague Mr. Knox said, the Germans were not very smart. They were careless.
Very true, Dr. Turing. Or they just thought that the Allies were stupid. Is that possible?
It is quite possible. But you do realize that we must overcome our own major problem. As you know, Dilly, we had wheel and plug settings for certain days with enciphered messages to go with them, but without a machine in front of us, we are unable to work out the order in which the keys were attached to the machine's various electrical circuits.
Now, we need a machine. A real Enigma machine, not one that we have created ourselves.
Well, perhaps one of our convoys out in the North Atlantic might be lucky enough to capture an Enigma machine from a U-boat. Wouldn't that be delicious if we could do that?
Miss Seaway, that would be terribly delicious if we could do that.
Dilly, maybe we could also implement that wildcat scheme of yours?
What the blazes is that, Dr. Turing?
Professor Knox, would you be so good as to explain to Miss Senyard what that is all about?
Oh, please do, Professor.
The wildcat scheme was one solution that the Birch Naval Section came up with. Simply put, a meaningless jumble of letters would be sent out in Morse code on one of the frequencies used by the U-boats. It was hoped that this would provoke a predictable reply, which could then be used as a crib.
And what did you want to do with this scheme of yours?
I hoped that we could ask for a bogus signal to be sent out asking for the Enigma settings. The settings for all four of the rotors.
Dilly, did it work?
Naval Command decided not to put my plan into action. Too dangerous, I presume.
Dangerous. Let me tell you about dangerous. I had an alarming experience of real war. I got a weekend leave and was traveling by bus from Berkhamsted Station after getting there by rail from Bletchley. En route, a German V-1 flying bomb cut out near the top of Nashley Hill, just outside Chesham. The bus driver zigzagged, but the flying bomb went just over us and landed the other side of an adjacent field and luckily exploded into soft ground. It was a small crowd at the bus stop at the bottom of the hill that marveled at our luck.
What happened then?
We all got off the bus. I ran over to where the bomb had exploded, and then I saw it.
What did you see, Alan?
Here's what I heard. The London air raid sirens howled. The V-1 tore across then England at over 350 miles per hour, faster than almost anything the British could put in the air against it, skipping past the barrage balloon's steel cables that were intended to tear off its wings, outpacing all the efforts of the anti-aircraft gunners to traverse their guns fast enough to blow it out of the sky.
What did you see, man?
Death, destruction, and this piece of propaganda lying on the ground, right next to a rose bush that was not destroyed by the explosion.
Read it to me.
It says, V-1, those roaring monsters of the air, are smashing London and the supply bases in England with dreadful precision. Regarding V-1, the First Lord of the Admiralty, Alexander, made it plain that England is facing hard times, and that the German weapon is the most modern and most deadly form of attack from the air. You fellows on the Italian front are lucky to be far away from the hell turned loose over England.
Those damn Nazis.
As the three OSS spies are getting settled in over in Hut 8, let me remind you that the Allies need to capture one of the coding machines, or Enigma material, being used by the German Navy. This is absolutely crucial to winning the Battle of the Atlantic, in which U-boats were attacking convoys bringing essential supplies to Britain. The Allies need to find out where the U-boats were assembling and when they might attack the convoys, but their codes were extremely difficult, if not impossible, to break. Bletchley Park, near Milton Keynes in Buckinghamshire, became the national center for code breaking. In 1941, the Atlantic raged fiercely. German U-boats prowled up and down the seas, sinking British convoys with impunity. It was the Royal Navy's darkest hour, with supremacy of the Atlantic very much in doubt. Once again, here is Captain Horatio Faulkner, who's head of Joint Naval Operations.
There is no doubt in anyone's mind that we must capture a U-boat and secure an Enigma machine. The Germans are supposed to think that Enigma is an unbreakable system, because it would take thousands of years to go through every setting to find them the one that turns the code back into the plain text. Next day, it's different again. Using human beings, Enigma is safe forever. But we don't use human beings for that. We use our own Alan Turing at Bletchley Park. Isn't that right, Miss Senyard?
Oh, yes, Captain, you are correct. And that is the secret inside the secret. All they know is the weather code opened a crack in the system because somebody told them. But what if somebody tells them just how we do it? Your thinking machine, clackety-clack day and night, programmed with a menu, thanks to your big brain, that reduces the odds to just a few million to one, till it locks on to the winning combination. And there goes the war.
That is why we must capture U-Boat 110. U-110 is vital to us.
The Enigma machine?
Yes. Phoebe, we are fortunate to have three women from the OSS with us here at Bletchley.
Oh, yes, I know. Catherine, Millie, and Agnes. They're part of General Donovan's petticoat brigade.
Miss Senyard, none of us hardly wear petticoats. We all prefer slacks and long-sleeve shirts.
Well, that's right, Catherine. We want to fit in with all those handsome men all around us.
And more importantly, we have to be able to take action when we need to.
Action? What do you mean, Millie?
We have to be able to shoot and kill the enemy or use one of our blades and slit their throat.
Oh, how gruesome!
Look, Miss Senyard, we all have a job to do, just like you. Maybe you think that Americans are a bit on the soft side, but let me assure you, you are incorrect.
Why, I never thought that.
Oh, well, you better not, sweetie. Say, isn't it about time for an afternoon whiskey and water?
Oh, Agnes, not now. Captain, we are more interested in the status of U-110.
I can tell you all about U-110.
Oh, what do you mean?
The second U-110 was a Type 1XB submarine of the Kriegsmarine. Her keel was laid down February 1st, 1940, by A.G. Wesser of Bremen, Germany. She was commissioned November 21st, 1940, with Captain Fritz Julius Lemp in command. Lemp commanded her for her entire career. The second U-110 conducted two patrols, sinking three ships totaling 10,149 tons and damaging two others totaling 8,675 tons.
But why is this important to know?
Now, let her continue, Phoebe.
Thank you, Captain. On March 23, 1941, her 105-millimeter deck gun exploded during firing, wounding three men.
Thank you, Millie. By the way, why do you keep on saying that U-110 is the second one?
Because during World War I, U-110 was launched on July 28, 1917. That was the first U-110.
Well, just a minute. I think we have contact with the U-boat.
What are the coordinates, Captain?
Let me check. 60 degrees, 28 minutes north, and 32 degrees, 40 minutes west. Well, how did you know that?
Well, that's where they were expected to be, in the North Atlantic.
Well, what else do you know?
U-110 was attacking a convoy along with U-201 in the North Atlantic south of Iceland. The Republic of Iceland is an island nation in the northern Atlantic Ocean, located between Greenland and Scotland, northwest of the Faroe Islands. When Captain Lemp left his periscope up too long, the escort, HMS Aubrija, spotted it and began dropping depth charges.
I wonder what Commander Lemp of U-110 is thinking right now.
Do you think he's a bit concerned? Especially when the effect of those depth charge attacks wrecked the interior of U-110. And the hydroplanes were put out of action at an early stage, as was the rudder soon afterwards. The rudder indicator was smashed, and also the compasses. And oil from a damaged fuel tank has penetrated into the U-boat near the galley.
Should I even ask how you know all of this?
Well, you might want to ask General Donovan.
I don't have time for that. I think I'd rather hear what Commander Lemp on U-110 is saying right now.
Commander Lemp, what's our next move now that our compression tanks are leaking oil?
Mr. Ulrich, we have few options remaining. I don't believe we have any choice. The British corvettes, the Bulldog, and the Broadway have joined in the hunt. They are planning on ramming us once we surface.
How do you know that, Commander?
They know we are leaking oil, and they can see our air bubbles. And the residue from our other tanks, they know.
Yes, I understand.
We must surface. We have no choice. We must also prepare to abandon ship.
Prescribe your orders, Commander, and I will relay them to the crew.
The conning tower hatch must be opened quickly once we surface, and then all hands be ordered to abandon ship as quickly as possible. I will stay on the bridge and make sure all of the men will leave the ship safely and quickly.
Commander, are you planning on leaving the boat?
I will make sure everyone and everything is safely off the boat. Then I will leave the boat.
Catherine, I suppose you know exactly what's going to happen to Commander Lemp and what will come of the Enigma.
I can only surmise, Captain, but I do believe that I am quite accurate in this assessment.
Well, go on then.
The British naval seamen made several journeys between U-110 and HMS Bulldog to collect whatever they could get their hands on inside the boat. This must have been a real treat, as U-110 was abandoned in a hurry, and being a 1XB class, she did not sink as rapidly as earlier class U-boats would likely have done.
No, is that all, Catherine?
No, Agnes, there is a bit more. The day after the boat was captured, someone realized that the Allies already had the most important part of U-110, namely the secret documents and the all-important Enigma machine, and that the Germans might find out that the British had the boat soon and, assuming the worst, change all codes and cipher system.
And the boat?
The boat thus accidentally sank when being towed to Britain. 15 men were killed in the action and 32 captured. Lemp himself did not survive. Some say that he committed suicide. We will never know.
What we do know is that Dr. Alan Turing, Dilly Knox, and all the other brave patriots who served at Bletchley Park were able to not only break the German naval code because of this important capture of the Enigma machine off of U-110, but they continued to provide naval intelligence to the British and her allies throughout the remainder of the war. It was this truly important Enigma covenant that turned World War II around, that was to result in the victory in Europe on VE Day, May 8th, 1945.
Ladies and gentlemen, Prime Minister Winston Churchill from number 10 Downing Street.
Yesterday morning at 2:41 a.m. at General Eisenhower's headquarters, General Jodl, the representative of the German High Command, and of Grand Admiral Dönitz, the designated head of the German state, signed the act of unconditional surrender of all German land, sea, and air forces in Europe to the Allied Expeditionary Force and simultaneously to the Soviet High Command. We may allow ourselves a brief period of rejoicing, but let us not forget for a moment the toils and efforts that lie ahead. Japan, with all her treachery and greed, remains unsubdued. The injuries she has inflicted upon Great Britain, the United States, and other countries, and her detestable cruelties call for justice and retribution. We must now devote all our strength and resources to the completion of our task, both at home and abroad. Advance Britannia! Long live the cause of freedom. God save the king.
Four months later, the war in the Pacific would end, and so would World War II. Our stars in today's original docudrama, The Enigma Covenant, were Mike Bevito, Chris Brooks, Julie Burton, Renee Bichelle, Siegfried Christoph, Vicky Dumay, Ryan Farrell, Jill Jensen, Susan Lean, Jim McClure, Andrew Potter, Larry Rowe, Cameron Spencer, and I'm Todd Eaves, your announcer. Support for the WGTD Radio Theater comes from the Kenosha Law Firm of Aaliyah, Dumay, and McTernan, a full-service law firm with an emphasis on personal injury, civil litigation, and business law, and also the Brown Ulstrup Performing Arts Foundation, located in Salem Lakes, Wisconsin, on the web at brownulstrupfoundation.org. For the WGTD Radio Theater and the 91.1 Players, I'm Todd Eaves. Thank you for joining us today for The Enigma Covenant.
WGTD HD, Kenosha Racine.